So the cynic in me is like, hey, you know, I'm AI this, AI that. I want to bump up my numbers. I want people to look think of me as looking forward-thinking companies. I don't know. That's the cynic in me.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back. Good to be out of San Francisco and all home. Pretty tumultuous week. Sunil, let me start with you because you were at the Innovation Sandbox, and that was early on Monday, and I did not make it in there, but I heard Gotti killed it for you guys. How was the experience?
It was amazing. The room was full of like 3,000 people, so being able to pitch in front of that group is great. And then it's high pressure, right? Super high pressure situation. So kudos to Gotti for not crumbling under that pressure. He actually pulled it off pretty well. The winner at the end, so everyone got a $5 million check, which makes, I guess in some respects, everyone a winner, but there is still only one selected at the end. And a company called Project Discovery won the judges' vote. I think if I were in the same situation and we weren't part of the group, then I would have actually picked the same company because they've done a lot to contribute to the security community through the open source project Nuclei. Just being able to highlight that contribution, I think, is a good thing to do. As far as a company is concerned, I'm not sure how well they're doing as a company per se, but in terms of being able to do something that's meaningful for the industry writ large, they would have gotten my vote. I remember when the investment opportunity came through for Project Discovery about 2 or 3 years ago. I think the biggest challenge really for companies that start with an open source project is to turn it into a commercial product. And I think that's the same challenges that they're going through as well.
Hey Sunil, and you're saying was it 5 million for? Was it the finals are 5 or 10? How many finalists?
Five. So the 10 finalists get a $5 million check. So the total investment made by Crosspoint Capital is $50 million across the 10 finalists.
Was it the same judges that did the screening to the 10s that were sitting there live to get pick the winner?
Yeah. So it was the same. Groups because there's a reason why I say it that way. It's because the judges didn't necessarily see all the submissions. They of course had teams that would go through and filter that for them within their own team. So some of the judges did go through all of them. Others had a team of people filter on their behalf, and then the judges went through and looked at the final top 10, or at least selected the top 10 out of the, I think, 400. I forget if it was 200 or 400 submissions. So quite a substantial number either way that you had to filter down.
And Sunil, for companies who are thinking about doing it next year and competing in the sandbox, was it like America's Got Talent and you had like 3 or 4 judges at the end listening to that 2-3 minute pitch? How did that, what was it like? Can you give us a little format?
Yeah. So there's I think Paul Kocher is the Simon Cowell of the group. He asks some very pointed and hard questions. But it's a good mix of both end user organizations, venture capital, analysts. I think in the past it was weighted more towards the VC side of the equation. And so I think they've brought some more balance to the judging panel in recent years.
Well, great. Great. Hey, and what's it been like since then? Have you noticed an immediate uptick in follow-ups off of that buzz?
Yeah, so there's definitely a huge amount of uptick, and we have the numbers to show for it. It's from the point of the announcement all the way through RSA, there's a steady growth in terms of, actually not just a steady growth, it's a pretty sharp growth in terms of visits and coverage and all these sort of things. So all in all, a very positive thing for anyone who can get into the top 10. And again, we feel pretty privileged to be able to get selected for the top 10. And having a $5 million check is also nice too, right?
Fantastic. Yeah, congrats on that. I mean, well done. Seems like a great experience all in all. Mm-hmm. So speaking of the cyber industry and all of that, you know, one of the things that came across the wires recently was about CrowdStrike announcing a 5% job cut, which is weird because I think they could have just done that and it wouldn't have been noticed that much, but they decided to attribute it to AI in an internal company. Man, people get so awkward when it comes to delivering bad news and just start saying things that end up burning them worse and worse. But I guess that's realistic, though, that AI is going to disrupt some labor and whatnot. Do you think that's real here, or was it just something silly that somebody said when they're actually just trimming costs?
Yeah, I suspect that it was partly a combination of both, right? That one can ask as a part of the interview, hey, does AI have anything to do with it? And of course, even if 0.1% of that 5% were due to AI, the headline becomes it's because of AI, right? But that said, I mean, I think it is still a sign of the future and one that we should be girding ourselves for. More and more of these job cuts are going to be because of AI, or the diminishing number of job opportunities in the traditional fields that we've been that can be displaced by AI will gradually be reduced. The whole premise, though, is that new jobs, the whole economic theory behind a lot of this is that new jobs will open up. But I'm not sure necessarily what those new jobs are going to be yet. I'm not sure if folks have a clear understanding of what that looks like.
Well, you know, I was having dinner with someone last night, and this came up from a different direction, and he was talking about he's doing something pretty complex for, I think it was a private equity firm that was doing some deep portfolio analysis, and he was using AI for that, and he was able to return something back to them in less than a week that would have taken, and it would have been like a McKinsey or a BCG type strategic study that would have been a multi-month and at least a six-figure project, if not a seven-figure. But what I thought was really interesting was that he wasn't saying, like, I just threw in the ChatGPT and they did it. He was going through the hours he spent to get it right and refine the prompt. And he was very proud of himself. Like, he identified not many people would have been able to do that. So he still force multiplied like crazy. But I think maybe that's the new job, right? Is that I'm a, you know, prompt whiz. I'm a prompt wizard in fixed income or whatever it may be that can leverage the tools better than everyone else.
So the cynic in me is going to say, I'm sure all of us look at CNBC and watch CNBC, but in the last 12 months, you know, there isn't a CEO that comes, I mean, maybe a few CEOs in here, but practically every CEO I heard interviews of always throws in the AI angle. All right. So the cynic in me is like, hey, you know, I'm AI this, AI that. I want to bump up my numbers. I want people to look think of me as looking forward thinking companies. I don't know. That's the cynic in me. You know, George also from CrowdStrike also said that the market conditions are also challenging at the moment, given what's happening in the world. So, you know, AI challenges in the world, economic conditions. Okay, got it. And then when I look at the report that CrowdStrike says, they didn't go into detail about what departments they were cutting. They just said front end and back end. So so I don't know enough what to make of it. Here's what I've seen, anecdotal evidence. I'm in San Francisco. And if you're looking for commercial real estate in San Francisco, and everybody who listens to our podcast knows it's not doom and gloom in San Francisco. It's actually really freaking competitive in the commercial space for a specific size of companies. Care to guess what size that is? 2,500 square feet.
Oh.
So the 2,500 square feet has become really competitive. You're looking at 8,000 to 10,000 a square, 8,000 to 10,000 monthly, excluding utilities. Why do I say this? Well, the vast majority of these companies are AI startups. They're just everywhere, right? They're not. They don't need to get these big spaces. They want small spaces. I looked at a company in their space. We were thinking about subleasing it, and the company's name is Gamma. And I looked them up and said, what? Because they told me they had grown in less than 6 months. They had doubled their size. In a year, they had tripled their size. And they were excited. Good. Awesome. Love it. Gamma. What do you do? they do AI PowerPoint. They have an AI agent that creates PowerPoints and social media posting, etc. I'm not demeaning that, but I'm just saying that's
they're blowing up, dude. I heard about them last night again. They're getting name dropped everywhere.
Right, and so here's where I'm a little concerned about future jobs. It's not the folks like the gray hairs that have been around and I can see some of these hallucinations created by these models and say, you know what, that's not accurate. Because you come through experience, you understand the particular vertical you're in. I'm worried about the new graduates coming out of college that don't have that experience. The people that would go and work for the McKinsey's, the EY's, or for the startups that would do a lot of those, you know, beginning your career, doing a lot of grunt work. I think that's where these AI agents and models are actually impacting the job.
So one consideration is, again, I'm thinking about rethinking what jobs look like. Back when photography became widely available, all of a sudden you had massive displacement of all the people who could do landscapes and portraits. And what we ended up with was folks like Salvador Dali and Picasso, who reimagined what painting and art looks like. But what that reimagined thing looks like was vastly different than what anyone can expect, or anyone would expect. In fact, you know, I think people were shocked by what was produced. And I think we'll have to think about, like, what is that shocking thing that jobs will be like in the future? And here's another interesting perspective as well that I've been noodling through. I talked to a lot of kids out of, I used to hire a lot of interns, and many of these interns, they want to come out and say, hey, I want to, I'm a go-getter and I'm already ready for management. I'm like, no, you're not ready for management. But here's the thing that I think is actually somewhat fascinating. What essentially these agents are, is their own interns. So think of every agent that we have as an intern. And what is it that we need to do? Well, we need to manage it. We need to make sure that they're properly instructed, that they have the proper guardrails, that we provide the proper oversight. And if we have, if the graybeards have already had management experience, to us, it's kind of like, oh, of course, that's easy. But if you're a person right out of college, you may not know how to manage a whole bunch of agents, because that's very similar to how we think about managing people, right? But nonetheless, I think the opportunity is for students, for grads, you know, for folks who recently graduated to get that skill now and to understand how do you shape these agents in such a way that it's very similar to, again, you just hired a whole bunch of high school students. How do you manage them so that you get whatever you're trying to do accomplished? And if they can learn that skill, then they actually have been able to advance quickly in their career, because they can demonstrate that. If they can demonstrate that with computer agents, they can also, or AI agents, they could potentially demonstrate that with real people too.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I say a lot, and I think this is very relevant to this, is like macro versus micro. And what we're talking about is macro, is macro employment market trends. And it's important to talk about, and it will make a difference, especially in the long game, to people. And so we're talking about things that might evolve over 5 to 20 years. But somebody graduating right now from school should not take this and change their outlook and be like, oh, I'm going to change careers because of AI. I'm not going to bother. I'm not going to get it. That's ridiculous. It's like when people are trying to sell a home and they go to housing starts and they look at the macro market and say, well, I don't know if it's a good time to sell. Like, how many houses are you going to sell? One? You could sell one house anytime with some heroics. And so as an individual, you know, you can land a job on heroics, on skill, on all that, and differentiate. Don't let this macro data change what you're going to do tomorrow.
I don't know, Jerry. I'm going to push back on that. Yeah, I got to push back on that. I was on I had a ride on a Lyft driver. We started chatting. This was about 6 months ago. And as he was driving, and I just asked, how long have you been doing this? He's like, blah, 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 years. But I'm studying. He goes, I'm going to get out of the driver, the shared driving or Lyft or Uber, which I thought was great. Awesome. You should be doing that. And he's studying. And you know what he's studying for? Accounting. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. I didn't want to tell the guy, I don't know if I want to go into accounting, because a lot of accounting jobs are going to be replaced by some of these agents. Mm-hmm. So, Jerry, I think go and learn critical thinking. That's my advice. If anybody's in college, that's what I tell my kids, be a critical thinker.
I did a call with Puzzle. So Puzzle, I think it's puzzle.ai. I hope so. They're a bookkeeping AI heavy bookkeeping SaaS platform. I'm using it. So the opposite of being conflicted, I'm actually giving them money. But it's cool. I'm liking it so far. I haven't looked at the whole field. I can't tell you it's the best, whatever. Not necessarily a plug, but I'm liking it. So I did the onboarding finally, and I'm talking to this guy who's like a Silicon Valley dude, and he's really sharp, and I'm enjoying the conversation, and we're talking about UI, and I'm confessing that I don't know a damn thing about bookkeeping, and I shouldn't be in here, but whatever, and we're getting on it. And then I asked about his background, and I expected him to be a software engineer, right? He's a bookkeeper. when I did bookkeeping, we did it this way. Like, I was asking about reconciliations, how important is that, a small company, and so on. And so all that to say, maybe your Lyft driver is on a good trajectory here, because he's still got to get the accounting bones down before he can ever apply models and be a prompt engineer. Yeah? All right, cool. Hey, the next thing on our docket, one of our own here, Kirsten Davies, who I know I've run across her many times in person and in Slack work groups and all that, was selected as the Pentagon CIO. She was, I think, most recently the CIO of Unilever.
Says so.
I read CIO. Maybe she got promoted this same article, not to denigrate the authors, but I thought it was a phishing link because it says congress.gov. I don't know if anyone spotted that. And so I was double checking, like, really, is that like a Lampoon site that has news or whatever? And it's just a broken link. It was just a typo in the article. So maybe they also typoed CIO versus CISO. But that's pretty cool. Did you guys have any input on this, or did you have any background or expect it to be happening?
Yeah, so Kirsten and I go back a ways. We used to work with each other professionally back during our Booz Allen days. And, of course, I know her personally as well. So I think she's built a wonderful reputation as a world-class cybersecurity executive who we can trust and build amazing teams and navigate the complexity of geopolitical type of things. But I think more importantly, I think her nomination represents more than just this personnel decision. I think it's a powerful signal that cybersecurity is not just an afterthought, but really rather a strategic imperative for national defense. And I think by nominating a veteran CISO to serve as the Pentagon's top IT official, I think it's really, the administration is really recognizing what many of us have long argued, which is that in today's landscape, the CIO's role really can't be separated from the responsibility to defend the digital infrastructure. And so I think CISO should be like really super excited about this. We may have political disagreements on, certain things, but in terms of as an industry to have a CISO elevated in this way, I think is fantastic for recognizing the type of value that the security leaders in our community can bring to the table.
Yeah, super valid. Yeah, I totally agree. Someone having that background, really great. I mean, I know in my org, I spun someone out from security that became the CIO and ran all of IT, and that was such a big win. I mean, security is so much less expensive when you have that kind of setup, because they're just always thinking about that as a default and not bolting on and retrofitting things later on. So good. Hopefully a big win for the Pentagon.
Oh, and I should say, it's also kind of cool because both so you have Kirsten as the CIO and Katie Arrington as the CISO. So you have two women who are basically having these top roles on the IT side and the security side, and both have security sort of focus. So I think it's a very positive sign.
I don't know personally, Kirsten, and so, but congratulations. But I'm going to take the cynic route. And I think there's been a lot of bad juju, bad activities, poor judgment by some of these folks using apps that they should not be using, especially when they're talking about, attacks on other countries. So good for you. You found somebody who's actually a serious player. This might give you maybe, get that noise away from you. But I think the larger thing, if I get away from the cynic and the political side of things, I think there's something what Sunil and Jerry have said before, and we've talked about in other episodes, is this convergence between the CIO roles and the CISO roles. And what I've heard, and because, you know, we're CISOs, right? Is that CISOs are in a better position to replace some of the CIOs. Now, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if somebody's been smoking that funny stuff in San Francisco, but maybe this is a new thing, new trend.
Yeah, I've definitely seen a trend, even in midsize and smaller, of the security leader taking on IT. And I did that early in my career, and it was like a vacuum filling situation, though. And I don't know if that's as common, meaning there's nobody else that's really taking it over and they're investing a bit more in security. I do know when it came to governance that it was a regulatory mandate around security and not so much around operations and IT generally. And so as a result of that, security led the way on formality, like actually having a governance meeting and a fixed agenda and you know, formal stamps on policy changes and that sort of thing. And so it made sense later to apply that and project that onto IT so you don't have to duplicate the expense and ops. So maybe like all the weight and all the push that's happening in security has some benefits here that can then knock on to CIO positions. And maybe that's why it does make sense to have someone like that.
Well, in some respects, I don't think this fits the DoD model, and you'll see why. In many smaller organizations, the CIO function really is not really needed in that you don't really have a lot of in-house applications or in-house systems to have to deal with. Really, the only thing you have to deal with is the endpoint infrastructure and maybe the network, which really at the point, you know, there's not much of a network for many smaller organizations. Most of the enterprise applications have moved into SaaS, right? And so what does the CIO really have left to do? And I think that space is shrinking, except in DoD, where you can't really use SaaS for a lot of things. And so you have to deal with a lot of internal systems and whatnot. I think the challenge that I think the CIO function is definitely a needed function in the context of these larger enterprises that can't move, or these types of enterprises that can't move purely into cloud/SaaS environments, because there's going to be a lot of stuff that you still need to make sure is operational and works, especially for something as critical as a warfighter mission.
That's interesting you say that. Wow, this brings me back some memories. I think to an extent, Sunil, when it comes to the DoD, I mean, there's such a thing as DoD IL4 and IL5, and then there's IL6 and 7. I think you're right. I think when you get into the IL6, there's definitely less of that SaaS world. But in the DoD IL4s and 5s, and that those are just, if anybody, is just a framework like FedRAMP for DoD. IL4 is entry level. 5, it gets a little harder. But there is a lot of SaaS-ness in that space. And I can see why this could make what you just said about CIOs in the commercial world, in the public world, public enterprise world, starting to have an impact in DoD. Maybe you're right.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I was talking to a startup yesterday in very early ideation phase around network security. And we were talking this back and forth of like, where did the network go? You know, like you care about the network, and there's still networks. They're just kind of hidden and abstracted from everyone these days. And that said, even in the old on-prem world, controls could sometimes move to the endpoint. Like we did things in the network because we owned the network, we saw the network, and we can plug things into the network, into switches. But over time, things like Zero Networks, if you guys are familiar with that one.
Yeah.
I think Illumio was in this too. The idea of automating, whether it's agent-based or the native operating system capabilities, so that you make all these endpoints in concert emulate network-based controls. Like mm-hmm. If you tell the endpoint it can't go out, it's just as good as blocking it at the network at the end of the day. So I think even though like it's good that trend started, because it's going to be absolutely necessary when there's no network engineers left, right? I mean, when the thing's just on autopilot, then DevOps is now running the network, or lack thereof.
Yeah, and it's already moving that way as well. I forget the name of the protocol. It's not Tor, but it's like a Tor-like system. that is meant to be is meant to obfuscate origin points and destinations across the entire internet at scale. So basically, think Tor at scale, and I forget what the name of the specific protocol is, but Google and many of the other large providers are looking to adopt that. So at the end of the day, the network becomes less and less relevant, and the endpoint becomes more and more relevant. That said, also going back to something that Mario said, I think what's interesting about this administration is that they're also they have a really, really strong push towards innovation and adopting new and innovative technologies. And that can, of course, bite us in the wrong way with the Signal fiasco or the what was it called, the TM, whatever, TM Signal, telemessage Signal app itself. But I think the push towards adopting more commercial technologies may go to what Mario was saying, that we end up with where the CIO just manages those SaaS technologies and less of the footprint of on-premise technologies. I think for DoD, there's still going to be a ton of on-premise stuff, you know, just because of the nature of what they do and the assurance that you want. I mean, you don't want the SaaS provider to go down while you're fighting a battle, right? You need that assurance that the things are going to work on site. But anyway, that said, there's a strong push that we'll think that this administration is going to try to drive towards the be more willing to adopt and to take some risks along those ways, along those lines too.
Yeah, totally. Jerry, you said something about this, that network, the network engineers, we don't see them as much anymore, right? Just thanks. Like AWS, when's the last time you really saw problems with AWS's network? Every so often you'll see a beat, but we've outsourced that to AWS, as Azures and GCPs of the world. Let me ask you a question. What about in the security space? Is there something similar of jobs potentially that we're doing today in security that are going to get replaced by these AI agents very shortly, where they become like the network engineers of yesterday? Do you see a space in security? Because I was thinking about CrowdStrike and going, what jobs in security at CrowdStrike, if there are any, are being laid off?
Well, actually, personally, I think with certain types of system configurations, you don't want a non-deterministic answer or non-determinism to factor in. I still see a human in the loop that says, "Okay, let's just make sure that this is a valid configuration," because you just don't want randomness. Randomness in that sort of situation is going to potentially be problematic. I can imagine at some level, though, if you introduce randomness, you can we'll have a way to do what if scenarios to determine to run the simulation to see what the outcome would be, and if it doesn't match the desired outcome, then you go back and say, "Hey, AI system, you messed up. Let's do a feedback loop." Because of course, humans make mistakes, and we're non-deterministic in some respects.
We're awful. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the Waymo problem, if I can brand it that, in that Waymos are going to hit some people now and then, and any time that they do, the world's going to panic and you know, come marching to the Waymo headquarters with torches. They're going to kill a lot less people than the humans did, than the human drivers. Like, I feel a lot better. I saw it, you know, when I was in San Francisco for RSA, I saw people walk in front of a car because it was a Waymo. You know, I mean, just like without even a second glance. Like, they just, oh, it's a Waymo, boom, walk right across in front of a car that had a green light. I think that's a terrible policy. But it shows, I mean, people get it. They are a lot more reliable. And it's the same with any of these adoptions, and including if .gov as a whole and or the DoD start biasing towards modern technologies. I mean, I think there is an argument for there's going to be a few gaffes, and people are going to bring them to the highlight. But net, it's going to mean that warfighters have a lot more drones a lot faster when they need to win the battle. And you can't do that with bureaucracy.
Yeah, and I think the challenge really is going to be unexpected failure modes at scale. And going back to the Waymo San Francisco example, I have video during RSA of this Waymo that was stuck in front of the Marriott Marquis for 10 minutes because there was a stream of people walking by it. Yeah. And you had all these cars behind it just honking because it wasn't aggressive enough to cut people off and get into the lane. And so you had, it was probably more than 10 minutes. Like, I didn't stay that long for it, but
totally.
I mean, there were some irate drivers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, the Waymo, when there's when it stops to let somebody walk by, it in the back of the Waymo, there's a little sign of a person walking. So the driver in the back knows, it's somebody in the front, somebody walking. But it frustrates the heck out of people. I just goes back to what security jobs are going to be impacted in the next couple of years. Hmm. I tell you one, if you're outsourcing to countries, like an example of India, because they do jobs for less money than you would for somebody in the United States, I'm telling you right now, those jobs are first in line to get replaced by these AI agents. Okay?
Hmm. That only makes sense. I hadn't thought about it. Yeah. It makes sense. And what are the... I mean, that's kind of... I always said, like with the offshoring model, I thought it was inhumane to model it as 3-for-1, right? You got a lot of that, like, oh, Mario, I need you to outsource, but look, I'm going to let you have 3-for-1. And it's like, are you saying that people are not that good, but if you throw a bunch of not good at a problem, it's equal to one good, you know? But that is the same mindset with AI, and including error rates or anything else like that. It's just that the speed. And I mean, you guys probably know more about this than I do, but I was just talking to someone about, I forget what it's called, but like groups or clusters of AI agents where you have them all do the same problem and argue with each other.
Yep.
Right. And that's totally premised on they're fungible, ephemeral, fast, cheap. Let's just spin them up and keep on going. So it's a good point.
There was somebody I was talking with and was asking, recommendations and about building a security team from early on. And they were thinking about outsourcing it or offshoring to a place in India for $45,000 is what they were thinking, $45,000 for a person. I say, why bother? Go to this company, is already doing like 90% of what you're asking for, and they're going to charge you $35,000, and it's going to be more consistent. Think about that. More consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. Humans aren't deterministic, you know? And especially when it comes to like some of the more, rating the severity of an incident, and therefore the implications are who's going to get notified, is it reportable, all that. You do it 100 times, you're not going to get the same answer 100 times. The severity of a finding out of Tenable or Wiz or an audit exam or anything else like that, same thing again, like just applying the scores of that. So I welcome the idea of having something that's more deterministic than humans, even though it's not truly deterministic. Hmm. So one of you mentioned earlier the tech bias and then the Telegram usage. That brings up our next topic here. So man, this escalated quickly, right? So just like to bring everybody up to speed. So you had the whole, why are people using Signal in the White House inner circle? And then that turned into someone taking a photo and I forget if it was a briefing room or situation room or whatever it was. But Mike Waltz had his phone out and they saw that he was using Signal. And when I first saw it, I thought it was totally a hoax because of the fidelity on the the resolution on the image was amazing. Gorgeous. Yes. Like, yes. Yeah, I saw like J.D. Vance. I'm like, yeah, that's just mocked up totally. But I guess it's real.
No, it's that movie, Enhance, and all of a sudden
I keep saying that. Nothing's happening. So, but in that particular screenshot, what people noticed is they were using telemessage, which is run by Smarsh. I remember Smarsh a million years ago when we were looking at e-discovery platforms and journaling. And they were great. I personally liked Smarsh, and they lost because they were such a small incumbent, and we went with like Global Relay or Autonomy or one of those at the time. So they obviously have a retention thing for Signal. I assumed it was like a plug-in or something like that, but from reading the articles repeatedly, I'm convinced now it's actually a forked version of Signal. It's kind of bespoke, and that's what people are using. And it has message retention in it. And they got popped. I haven't gotten into the nitty-gritty yet. I don't know if either of you guys do about whether the actual retention store was popped and therefore messages were already read post-retention, or if something in the actual app, like side channel, was popped where some users of it could be actually at the endpoint interdicted, or what it was. But they do message retention, and a bunch of messages from some companies were pulled out of there. And, you know, there's a little bit of headline of that, of like, how could they be using something that's vulnerable? But what I thought about when I read that was retention and end-to-end, certainly, but any kind of secrecy, end-to-end encryption included, are at odds, are at extreme odds.
Well, keep in mind, we also have... it's a legal requirement that we've imposed, which is good from the standpoint of a transparent democracy, that we want to hear what we want to see. We want to know that these interactions amongst government officials is documented and captured. It's an interesting challenge that we're having to deal with. And democracy, transparency is what we all want, right? But it comes at the trade-off of something like what we saw here. There's also an interesting, I don't know if anyone has read Dark Wire. It's a story about how the FBI ran a encrypted phone business, the FBI. And they, of course, the number one constituent or customer for it was all these criminal gangs. And so the FBI ran this encrypted phone business where they were intercepting all these calls and messages amongst criminals. And they did a lot of interesting takedowns as a result of that. It's a fascinating story that it's still, pieces of it are still unfolding. And it happened during COVID too, so it wasn't that long ago. And but the whole point of it, point that I'm bringing up is that it's so easy to subvert these encrypted phone systems if you don't have true end-to-end, if you're allowing some sort of compliance-oriented function that siphons off messages, then you're creating an attack surface that can undermine the whole point of having the encrypted phones.
For the current administration, my advice on this, using commercially available applications to deal with information that's critical to the country, may I suggest that you do an investment like you did, Truth Social. Go build your own application, guys. Okay, if you want to go cover your tracks, go try to build your own stuff, make money out of it, and sell it to politicians all over the world that want to cover their tracks, okay? But I mean, I'm just joking, okay? But what I'm suggesting here is there are some things that are in the commercial space for commercial reasons, and things that are for the government should not be using commercial space applications, especially if you're dealing with trading secrets or talking about secrets. That's just the end of it. Look, as a publicly traded company or a private company with private investments, I always advise for your Slack channels, kill it after 7 days, destroy the data. Emails, 30 days, destroy the data, unless there are some regulatory things that you have to adhere to. If you do, find those, minimize them, reduce it, and just keep them for 5, 7 years, whatever that is. But the rest of the gang in your company, you don't need these things staying there forever. You don't. This idea that, one day I'm going to go find. It's the same concept of people that use Splunk or any SIM, and they want to hold on to these locks forever. You're never going to look at them. Right? After a year, that's just fear. We might find something that will show that I got compromised a year ago. Brother, you got compromised a year ago. It's already too late, man, okay? So if you're doing these commercial apps and you're in the commercial space, you're in a publicly traded company, just destroy your data after a week, okay? Put it in writing, make it very transparent, make it a policy so nobody thinks you're doing some shenanigans, and just do that. And for the government, you got to hold this information for a long time. Sorry,
Jay. I'll be adversarial this time and disagree with you, but in part. So, like, first, let me say there's always been a spectrum on message retention, right? So, in my experience, it was with insider trading rules like FINRA. Right. So that was pretty heavy handed as far as communication retention goes. And that was to look for insider trading. So there's rules around that. And broker dealers have to retain all communications and supervise them, which means subject them to this sampling protocol, which is just asinine and completely ineffective. But whatever. All that to say, FINRA knew and everybody knows that there were some messages that would not be subject to that. For example, when people were talking in person, no one ever has yet tried to say those are going to be recorded and supervised. Communication happens in person. For the longest time, mobile was just like a known elephant in the room. Nobody's going to talk about it. That stuff is not supervised. They moved phones to be recorded for certain roles, like desk phones back in the day. And it was there was a long period where it was the mobile phone's not recorded, but this one is, and everyone's just going to look the other way. There will always be a point where people say that's going to be beyond supervision. And a lot of times the constraint was technical. Like you just didn't have a way to record personal conversations. But then they kind of gussied it all up as not necessary and extreme. So I do wonder now, like, it's very easy to record our conversation right now and have an AI agent summarizing all of that and doing a hell of a lot better job at message supervision than compliance and autonomy or anything like that ever could. So the technology is going to take away some of these excuses, and more things are going to get drawn into the retention requirement, which is an awful shame. When it comes to actual retention policy, though, so we had a ton of different subs under different regulations, and I remember we constructed this whole awesome matrix, and I say awesome because it was actually Lucid, but we had 3-year requirements for things, 5-year requirements for things, 6-year, 7-year, 10-year. Like, you had records of the company that our corporate law had to be forever. You had 5-year SEC things as a public company. You had 7-year SEC things under a different regulation under SEC. It's this whole mess. And we went through this period where, like, what you just said, Mario, is the lawyer's take. Burn it all down. You only need it 30 days. And it's always, I just talked to my friends at company X, and that's what they do. And it's total BS. You know, people just say that they're doing that, and then someone takes it seriously, and they're like, well, if they could do it, then we could do it. And everyone agrees, and then every senior exec gets an exemption from it. And before you know it, you have 30 days for the stupid messages that are never going to incriminate you anyway, and perpetual retention for the ones that would, all for not much. But Hillary Clinton's emails, where am I going with this? The one thing I always said is if you burn down a message in 30 days, the person you sent it to is keeping it forever. And when it comes up in e-discovery and you think you're going to trump out, and I'm just talking about you, Mario, but when GC says, oh, well, yeah, they're going to bring it into court and when or in front of Congress. And when Congress turns to us and says, wait a minute, you didn't have a copy of this? It's okay because I'm going to bring my policy. And I'm going to say, well, look, we destroy things, so I'm just with policy. You're going to get laughed out of the room. The court of public opinion will eviscerate you. You cannot stand by policy, and maybe in some esoteric technical legal cases. But if you burn down messages right now, it's going to double incriminate you because they're not only going to come out from the counterparty you were speaking with, but now the narrative is going to be enhanced with, and Mario destroyed all the data trying to cover his tracks. And when you try to speak up, the mic's already off. If you're explaining, you're losing. Point, counterpoint.
I think the challenge with government is simply that we have to have some form of record retention for the sake of democracy itself. And so, yeah. Now, here's the thing I think fundamentally we are struggling with. We have these coarse-grained ways that we determine what should be kept and what should be tossed. But what if an AI system had some form of discretion that could say, okay, here's what should be kept and here's what shouldn't be kept. And not just the stuff that should be kept, but maybe it should be filed in a certain place that is locked away from general discovery, if you will. And if it is incriminating, well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to think about this one. If it's incriminating, as a public citizen, I'd like to make sure that it's captured, or as a shareholder, I'd like to make sure it's captured. But that said, there's lawyers find ways to make something that's innocuous seem incriminating, and being able to clean up that kind of stuff is also a good thing as well. But anyway, the point is that these AI systems, if you could have someone really adjudicate every conversation and make a wise decision on retention versus tossing, I think that's what we all want, because no one wants to sift through all these happy birthday messages and all the slop, human slop, not just AI slop, human slop that we have to go through. That's ultimately what we want. We just want a system that can clean up that slop and then file things in the right places.
You know, it's always having great conversations with you too, because there's always a nuance to everything. So I think just talking about Slack and Jerry, you're right. The minute that email goes outside your boundaries, it's game over. So let's park that as emails within the company, Slack conversations within the company. You mentioned about legal in the public opinion and how people say, so, well, you destroy these messages every month. You're covering your tracks. Well, let me tell you, one of the reasons lawyers worry about this is oftentimes there are a lot of Slack conversations between the fog of war that can be misinterpreted or not even misinterpreted, but used by the plaintiff to suggest that you're being, you're not behaving accordingly or properly. And the reality is, it's not even that you're doing something with bad intention. It's just a fog of war.
So I totally agree.
It's best to get
solar
rid of
winds,
that.
Right? Solar winds.
That's
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It.
So yeah. Here's a consideration. The fog of war, hindsight's 2020, but the fog of war is absolutely real. But unfortunately, during the fog of war, we don't actually capture how we made the decision. And therefore, all we have is the hindsight. Let's go back to this premise. What if everything is recorded? What if we can now replay the decision-making activity? What if we can say, well, what would you have done up to this point if this is all you knew, right? And the reality is people will probably arrive at the exact same decision that you made that you're being sued for, right? And so this perspective of retention could go in a way that favors having clarity of the rationale around why certain decisions were made at the time that they did, that they were made, and could absolve many people who are being wrongfully blamed for things that, in the end, everyone would have made the same decision anyway.
Yeah, I guess whenever I try to recast whatever you say, I'm in danger here because I need to make sure I get it right. But the imperfect information is always a problem, basically. And so the only North Star you could strive for is perfect information, which means recording more.
Or at least recording enough that you can, again, absolve yourself to say, look, this is all we had at the time. In the fog of war, this is all we had. And unfortunately, if there was a friendly fire accident, you at least understand the current state up to that point to say this is why things happen. And, if you think about the body cameras that police wear, it does absolve a lot of police officers because you can see exactly what happened up to that point. And many people, if they were put in the same situation, would have taken the same set of actions.
No. There are so many discussions that you have when the doors are closed that we have, and if we start, we're in a Zoom call, maybe people are not physically in that room, and one needs to have the liberty to be able to speak clearly and freely and feel like it's not going to potentially be used against them later. And if I worry that if people start knowing that they're going to record it for every Zoom call, especially one around security incidents, that they're going to be guarded, and that you're not going to get the real good conversations, right? You might have them like what Jerry just said. He's like, grab the phone, the cell phone. I know I'm using the Batman phone, and I'm going to get recorded if I use the Batman phone. But I got a cell phone. I'm going to give him a call on the cell phone because I'll really have the good conversation. And that's where things get a little interesting, to say the least. So.
You're right. I mean, because as an example, I remember working incidents where, like in real time, whether you know it or not, you're doing kind of analysis for competing hypotheses when you're working an incident, right? Like, what do you think it is? But those hypotheses themselves are all, toxic, right? Like, oh, maybe it was the butler. Maybe it was the maid. And what happens when you're on Slack and someone says, maybe it's the maid? Everyone immediately starts chiming in with like, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I saw her doing this. Or, she's remote and she's working from Eastern Europe. So all this stuff that, man, in hindsight, outside the fog of war, someone's like, what the hell is that thing? Especially once it's disproven and you move on to the next target. And then everyone's 100% innocent all of a sudden. That's the detritus that you don't want to drag into the message. Maybe to Sunil's point, maybe if you have an AI bot that's going through all of the history and constructing it and just sharing the conclusions, then maybe that stuff is important to build the final message but won't actually come out in the wash. I don't know. But in SolarWinds, it was a whole lot of, yeah, no wonder, it's such a mess here. We do crap security. And it's just popular to be sardonic these days. Like, that's what's cool, what's in, what's on TV, is to just crap on everything all the time. But it's really incriminating when it's in isolation. Mm-hmm. Incriminating. All right. Next topic here. So, the thing that I know in my CISO circles, a lot of people are talking about Pat Opet and the CISO of JP Morgan. He penned an open letter to third-party suppliers. It was actually on the JP Morgan website. And look, for a senior executive of any public company, especially a massive juggernaut like that, to write an open letter and get it through compliance and legal and all of that, it's not going to have massive teeth. It's going to be fairly broad, and it's not going to be incriminating. It's going to be something that it wasn't in Slack or whatever. So while my initial reaction to this was like, hey, it's kind of vague, it's kind of broad, it's not really, but I got to give kind of some slack. That's probably what was appropriate for the medium. But like, one of the things that and he's basically going on in here and saying, SaaS, the world is now relying on you, step up when it comes to security. And I think that it's true in large part that internet, default, open, everything is going to be connected by default now. And we're having to jump through hoops to deny things that we don't want to have open. And it used to be the opposite of that in the world. But I think if there was any particular fault that I had, he anecdotally notes that, and this is tough to do when you're speaking for JP Morgan, so I'm sure he got clearance and thought carefully about this, but he noted that he and they had been affected by supply chain issues, and that that's a real thing, and that when supply chain has a cyber incident, that it affects all the way through, so therefore all the supply chain needs to be more careful, and SaaS is the supply chain these days. But what I didn't like about that is, I would guess, and I'm totally speaking independently, but at least being in a large Fortune 500 financial juggernaut myself in the past, and more than that, and talking to a lot of different companies, the supply chain disruptions around cyber to me are 99% ransomware, and it's just the vendor's down. Why? Oh, ransomware. The law firm's down. Why? Ransomware. The SaaS service is down. Ransomware, and that is a straight up availability. Resiliency, having alternative providers. It could have also been tripping over the cord. You might, to say they need to have better availability. But the layperson reading cyber incidents in a third party, to me, is the narrative of, oh, people are breaking into the SaaS providers and using that to infiltrate the bank or using that to get in, and that's the exposure that's happening. And that's where most of the money gets thrown at. But I think in reality, it's way overweighted by ransomware, which is very different, and there's not that privilege connectivity necessarily involved in that kind of thing. They're just down.
Well, let me offer, you may be falling prey to the availability bias or the availability heuristic. The ransomware, as a in terms of occurrences, and especially in terms of losses, is actually a smaller fraction than, let's say, BEC. Okay, but you don't see as much BEC because it's not as obvious to the external party. When you have a third-party supplier go down because of ransomware, well, a lot of people do notice, and as a result, we'll get more news coverage out of that. Three or four years ago, I invested in a company called Valence, because I actually was concerned about exactly the problem that Pat was talking about with respect to these third-party suppliers. I called it at the time PITA, P-I-T-A, plugins, integrations, and third-party apps. And the fact that all these systems are essentially sharing authentication, but also authorization into things like your email, your calendar, all these other things that can essentially be now accessible from all these other third parties. And there wasn't really much control over that. And because of that, the kind of concern that I think Pat's talking about is really hits that concern. And at the time, Valence actually ended up pivoting away from this, because at the time, there was no media coverage of these types of attacks because it was all hidden. Like, you wouldn't know. So I think that the problem is absolutely there, and it's getting worse, and it's going to get even worse with agentic AI. Because they're going to ask for the similar permissions, and it's going to be less controlled, and you'll have API keys of all sorts running amok everywhere. And so I think the real challenge is that we don't have – there are a couple of challenges. One, we don't have a good set of standards for how we manage this. But two, I would also say, look, and we had this problem, again, at Bank of America too, which we have an opportunity – the large organizations have an opportunity to pave the way, not just say here's a problem, but also here's how we've tried to solve it internally. And maybe if we're more willing to actually share that externally with other companies, or you know, even open source it, we can actually move forward faster than we are today. But I think we typically hold back on those things, lest the attacker figure out ways around it, or just because we take pride in whatever we built and don't want to share it with other people.
Yeah. Well, I also think people over-worry about clearing things, and is it okay to what would the lawyers say? That's a painful conversation. I'd rather not have it, so let me just default to clam up.
Yeah. If something breaks, you know, reliable for some, you know, for this open source tool, and it's like, come on, this is already a known thing.
But yeah. I think, Jerry, I hear about the ransomware. I hear what you're saying. It makes, you know, it does grab the headlines, and it's probably happens a lot, and especially in small and mid-sized companies, maybe less larger companies. But the open source, I'm not pointing on open source. I love open source. But a lot of our third-party suppliers may be using open source packages, and these open source packages, we've seen it. We've seen it even last, we talked about it a couple of episodes ago or three episodes ago, where these open source packages are being manipulated to expose more data and become conduits of that. And once they get into that supply chain, and I'm not talking about supply chain in the traditional way, but just your SaaS applications, for example, they can become conduits for data getting exposed. Or, you know, so, and oftentimes those don't appear to get a lot of the attention as the ransomware, but eventually they do. And they come out, and when they do come out, it's a lot of money that was like stolen or data. And then people have to pay money, a lot of money after the fact.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the call to action from Pat was very, you know, congruent with Secure by Design. Of CISA. So I guess we just answered the question, who's going to replace CISA? It's going to be Pat. But evangelizing in general for software companies to get firmer about things. And you know, my qualm with Secure by Design out of CISA was just that they had a lot of audiences, and I felt like the average manufacturing PE-backed mid-market company didn't need to drop everything and worry about Secure by Design and their internal apps. But to JPMC's point, SaaS does, because SaaS has the exposure and it has the supply chain integration. So if there's anyone who should be paying attention to the Secure by Design docs, it should be the SaaS vendors. And I think
Jerry, I'm going to give you part of this, because the more and more we talk about this, I'm like, damn it, Jerry's right again. Darn it, he's right.
Oh, I'm liking this already.
And I also invested in a company. I think we, in a free market society, we make our decisions based on how we invest our money. Okay, so that's one of the things, basic concepts that I strive to and I adhere to and I embrace. So I invested in a company just like Sunil that was looking for open source publishers who publish new code in these open source packages, and determining whether they were legit, whether they were questionable, whether there were North Koreans uploading stuff, funky stuff on your open source package. And I swear, 3-4 years ago, I thought I was the smartest guy by investing in this company early on. Nothing has happened. So that just goes to show you that all this talk that we're talking about, well, if it's really a big problem, don't you think we would make more money in our investments?
Yeah. I mean, you got altruism versus profit too. So
and sometimes it's good ideas. It is a timing thing. I think in some respects, what we call the business application mesh is now called the NHI problem. So it's the same nature. The problem is the same, or the nature of the problem is the same, but how you spin it or how you package it can be, you know, it can be can appeal to different audiences in different ways.
Cool. Well, on a positive note, with supply chain, I would say, so you had a big headline for us security nerds was about Microsoft going to pass keys by default for new accounts. And to a lot of people, that they would call that phish-resistant MFA being default for new accounts. Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. I think a recurring theme that we haven't quite like penciled out but keeps coming back is, as a market leader, as a big juggernaut, whether it's on the buy side like JP Morgan or on the sell side like Microsoft, you have some extra power to be able to move the needle on things. And is that also a responsibility? And we talked last time about the big IDPs and whether it was worth it for them to try to lead a charge. And then, boom, here comes Microsoft. Yep. And as the headline says, 15 billion users gaining, let's say, passkey support.
Yeah. Well, so let's be okay. So let's make sure we break down this headline properly. So they they use passkeys by default for new accounts. The whole notion of secure by default, secure from the very beginning, I think that's wonderful. 15 billion users gained passwordless support. Those aren't new accounts, right? So so 15 billion users are forced to use passkeys, and 14 billion users call Microsoft support the next day saying, "Hey, I'm locked out," right? So it's the challenge here is, how do you do this midstream when there's a huge possibility of locking people out? This is why I mentioned, I think it was in a previous episode, that MFA enforcement should be from day one. Why? Because and we're talking the admins, right? The root accounts, the admins. Because if you screw something out and you screw something up and you lock yourself out, just blow away the account and start over, right? You have nothing to lose. But if you're doing that after the fact, then you have a lot to lose, and people are going to be very, very reticent to turn on MFA for root accounts, because you might actually you will lock yourself out, and then you're really screwed.
Yeah. No, you have such a good point. I mean, you know, like we were talking last episode, right, about being able to change the IDP platforms to not allow third-party apps to access your email and calendar by default. And I was, I was lamenting about how I did it here at my startup, and we put that on pretty quick and just broke stuff left and right, you know. And in 3 years, you know, ping me on this, but the whole goal of this company, of any startup, is to not be able to do that. It's for it to be such a mess. And I was sharing that it was just cool, like, seeing the things that break that you didn't realize. Like Reclaim, I use it to sync calendars. There's no exception handling coming at me. I just am missing appointments because the thing didn't sync them over, and I wouldn't have realized it otherwise. And all kinds of collateral damage that was fine and you could handle early at the onset. To Sunil's point, you could blow things away, start again. That had you done that at an established company, you would not be there for long.
Well, let me also argue, though, if you have too many guardrails at the beginning of a company, that company won't last long enough to be a big company.
Yeah. 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 No, that's a good point. That's a good point. Don't tell my staff that, because they'll remind me of it regularly.
We went through this effort. I think we talked about it, of going passwordless. If you're in a business, what we're talking about, and I think we need to make a distinction, maybe, please keep me honest, you two. But I think one of them is more like consumer at home versus commercial, or, you know, a company that you're working on. If I were doing this at a company like we did, you don't freaking turn on you don't flip them on day one or 2 days. You slowly migrate them out. And you start, you know,
You boil that frog.
You know, by the way, the frog actually doesn't swim. It actually jumps the minute it gets hot. Anyway.
Mythbusters here.
Yeah. It's totally Mythbusters. But anyhow, you slowly go through each department. You pick some of the ones who are going to embrace the technology first, and then it'll become your champions. And they'll love the technology. Everybody loves going passwordless. Come on, folks. Face, thumb, fingerprint, super easy. But when you're doing this with, you know, the user, you know, home users. How do you do that? Send them an email. Hey, do this now. I'm going to give you another 30 days. I'm going to give you 60 days. And it's just, it's really hard. And I feel for people like Microsoft. I feel for people for Google. They're trying to do the right thing because grandma and grandpa will be the first ones to complain that they got phishing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's totally fair. Hey, speaking of passwords, so Tilson, our intrepid podcast producer and security researcher, PhD candidate at Georgia Tech, he doesn't just do this because he's just so nice. It's also a way to stay plugged in, and so he brings us a lot of the security news. And one of the things he mentioned was that while working with 1Password, noticed that it wanted to let him download a master blaster password backup key, and I don't like those keys even existing to begin with, but it defaulted by putting in a PDF file and saying, like, wink wink, we hope you do something really secure with this. And he was just noticing himself, like, man, my muscle memory was to upload it to G Drive, and then I realized how awful that would be. Man, talk about, like, if you want to have secure by design, and I'm saying it's not for everybody, it's just for SaaS, whatever. It's for 1Password, though. Like, 1Password, sorry, you got to be secure by design. Man, that's awful. What's the right way to handle that?
So I remember, I forget which tool it was, but I remember one particular site said, here are the backup keys, and you need to print them out. And you didn't actually have an opportunity to save them or PDF them or anything. You actually had to print them out. I think it was like Windows for the backup recovery or something, if I recall now. But anyway, the point is that you could not print them out. You could not PDF it. You could not. You couldn't save it to your computer. You had to print it. Or I think it was even you had to put it onto a floppy disk or something like that. Anyway. Anyway, the point being, you had to you couldn't put it in your normal place. You had to do something that was very different than your traditional ways of storing stuff. It was in the irony, of course, is we tell people don't put your password underneath your keyboard or whatever else it might be, and yet effectively the outcome was you print this out and you stick it in some place that
put it in
the
monitor, man. Just put it in front of the monitor.
Nothing bad ever happened.
Come on.
Yeah, but it goes back to my earlier comment about you still need this. So this is a downgrade attack, right?
That's right.
Everything we need downgrades because we just forget things or we lose things or whatever else it may be. And so the question we have to recognize if we're passwordless or passkeys or whatever, there's some downgrade that you have to have. Otherwise, people will. Not be able to, they will lose more than getting hacked because they can no longer access it themselves, right? So at the end of the day, the question is, what's the appropriate downgrade for any of these situations? And is this, is there a better downgrade than this? And if there is, let's push for that. Mm-hmm. If there isn't, then this may be the best that we have.
And in threat models, you have to model against the downgrade, right? Because if you're an adversary, you're only targeting the phone someone up and ask for the backup code. Like, why are you going to waste your time with cryptography? You know? So you have to threat model that and come up with something that's going to be not appealing if you're an adversary. Mm.
I love when people actually try to make these files invisible in their folders, and they think, oh, great, nobody's going to see that, my invisible file. Really? Yeah. That's the first place I'm going to go after, any invisible file, right?
And that's why the FBI thing Sunil mentioned earlier with the fake encrypted phone service was perfect, because people are going after this fake control. And that's why I hate VPNs, and people need to stop telling people to use VPNs. Because if you have a VPN, it's great. You don't have to wade through all the internet noise. You just get things people are trying to hide. It's a perfect concentration point to actually steal the data, especially since you're routing it to a third party. I digress. All right, guys. Hey, that runs us into time here. Glad we were able to jump on this. Good to see you guys. Mario, I hope you're feeling better. I know you had a little bike toss in San Francisco during RSA week of all weeks. But looking forward to catching up with you guys again soon, and thanks.